serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 94-year-old Henry Len Oshner of California City, California. He's originally from Montana, and he's one of the last surviving members of Easy Company of the 101st Airborne's 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment, the unit celebrated by author Stephen Ambrose as the Band of Brothers. From France on D-Day to the Operation Market Garden Jump in Holland to the brutal moments in the Battle of the Bulge when the unit was surrounded, Mr. Oshner lived through all of it, and some of it is still too much to talk about. But he's given us a little glimpse of that history he lived, and many of those memories became fresh again in 2014 when he returned to Normandy for the 70th anniversary of D-Day. The presidents of France and the U.S. were there, of course, and Mr. Oshner also received a special gift from the mayor of the French town where he landed all those years ago, St. Mère Eglise.
I got a bronze medallion from him.
Did you get a sense of how the French people felt about you and what you had done?
They can't do enough for you. They loved you. They have a thing going, I don't know. I was told that the cemetery there, that every family has one tombstone and the area there, that they keep that area clean, mowed, and flowers on it all the time.
So the French people are tending to the graves of the American servicemen who died.
Uh-huh.
What was it like for you to see those cemeteries, to see all those crosses and those graves?
There was a bunch of them. And there was, four or five American GIs there. They found out that I was from the 506. And they're running all over this crowd, this graveyard, hunting for 506 on the tombstones. And they'd find one, and they'd holler, and here's one, you know. And I'd go looking, and no, I didn't know him, you know. But there were so many of us, you haven't got a chance to really get down and be close friends with anybody.
Sure.
And sometimes it was a good thing not to be.
Absolutely. And the other thing that comes to mind for me, as you described that first instance after you're on the ground in France and the guy next to you gets shot and you realize you're going to have to be fast and shoot them before they shoot you.
Uh-huh.
When you were back there 70 years later, did you ever consider what if? I mean, if one of those had gotten you, you never would have met your wife. Your four daughters would have never been born.
That's right.
No grandchildren. I mean,
I wouldn't be where I am. I wouldn't be alive.
Yeah. How do you explain all that?
You can't explain it. Leastways, I can't.
And we're just talking about your first battle. Uh-huh. You had another jump not long after in Holland.
Yeah.
Market Garden.
We was out of Carondare some distance and everything. And somebody says, we have to go back to England. So we went back to England, and they gave us some more training. And then they loaded us back in another bunch of airplanes and flew over Holland area, Nijmegen, and I landed in a little town called Zon, Z-O-N. But the Americans called it Sun, S-O-N. But that's where I landed, Market Garden, and then we fought Market Garden. Then we fought Hell's Highway. But on Hell's Highway, we were supposed to leapfrog with the British. We would jump them, and then they would jump us, you know, going down Hell's Highway. One time they didn't show up to go around over us, and we found out that it stopped for tea. That was kind of funny.
Is there something you think people need to know about those battles, that time in your service over there?
Just hope there's never another one.
Hmm. Well, there would be another big one for you, the Battle of the Bulge. You were in the worst part of it, in Bastogne.
As we were going down Hell's Highway, right around that area, we were bivouacked someplace there. We got word that we had to load up and go someplace. But they didn't tell us where. And they said, okay, we got all these vehicles. You get in this one, you get in that one, you get in that one. And I wound up in an army duck. And that was my transportation. So we traveled quite a while. Then we came to this town, and we found out it was Bastogne. We got set up in there. Then we find out, the Germans, when they'd fired their M88s at us, that was a dangerous weapon. Very accurate.
Mm-hmm.
They were good at it. They would fire these 88s, and we was in a forest. When it hit the ground, you know how a shell goes up like that?
Mm-hmm.
About 45 degrees, something like that. They found out it wasn't very effective. We found out that they made it for whatever it hit, it exploded. So they made it where if it hit a tree, it would rain down on you.
The tree burst, yeah.
Yeah. Me and about four others dug this hole in the ground about from here to there, 9 feet across and about 4 feet deep. And then we took and cut down about six trees. There was some laying there. And then we cut down maybe three or four. We laid it across the top of it from the dirt that was in there. We put it around it, and we put the trees on top of it across like that. Then we put our shelter halves, our tent halves, mm-hmm. on top of that. And whatever dirt we could find then, we threw on top of that. That way we had a chance.
Because otherwise, what you're saying is, if you're just camped out at the base of a tree, one of these 88s is going to hit the tree, and that shrapnel is going to come everywhere and could kill you while you're sleeping or you're just taking shelter.
Yeah. But since we had this hole in the ground.
Yeah, probably saved your life.
Probably.
But I understand an 88 shell came even closer to you than that.
Yeah. They made me a Jeep driver for this lieutenant, and I was assigned a Jeep, and of course on a front bumper 506, you know. But this Jeep, it was assigned to me. It was so cold. We had oil in that car, in that Jeep. It got hard, it got stiff. Mm-hmm. And in the mornings, it hardly wouldn't start. You'd almost have to build a fire under it in order to get it warm enough to start, you know?
This was the coldest winter they said they'd ever had, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They said it was the worst one they had in 50 years.
Uh-huh.
So anyhow, I'm sitting in there, and I'm trying to turn this, I'm turning the starter on, and it's going, and I don't think it's going to start, you know. And I was talking to them. This other guy, this other GI. He said, He said, come on, quick. He says, into the barracks there. And there was a building that was something like 60 feet wide and about 90 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about 40 feet high inside. And on the end of it had that swastika, the eagle or the whatever, the bird.
Yep.
And then they had that thing on the bottom with the swastika on it.
Right.
It was up on that wall, way up high. So I jumped out of the Jeep, and I run for the building. And we dove into the building. And as I dove into the building, this 88 landed right next to my Jeep. And it put shrapnel all over the poor thing. Got the radiator and everything imaginable. It got one little piece of shrapnel. It was about that big. And it went through my boot right here.
Uh-huh.
And cut my heel. So what happened? I just take off my boot, reached in my pocket, got a Band-Aid.
Uh-huh.
And went back to usual. Went out and looked at my Jeep. It wasn't drivable no more. And so they assigned me back to my company. And we went out to a town called Foy. And it's closer to the Germans. Mm-hmm. You could almost see them. And we had to fight with them, you know.
Well, and with that incident with your Jeep, I mean, I'm just thinking, if you wait a split second longer to get out of there.
If it had been that guy I was talking to.
Yeah.
He counts them. He was counting the incoming. And they say, when you don't hear one coming, that's yours.
Right.
It's got your name on it.
Yeah, and it did have your name on it.
Did have.
And if you would have waited another half second, it would have gotten more than just your heel.
That's right. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Probably sawed off a couple of legs or something.
Whew. You ever look back on all this and have a hard time understanding or believing all of it, that you survived all of that?
I never much thought about it. It just kind of...
Just the way it is?
Yeah.
All right.
Just before they assigned me the Jeep, I was standing guard at this, it's either a church or a monastery, I don't remember what it was. I never knew what it was, but I was standing there at this door, and I'm the guard. I don't know why. I'm the guard, and just inside the door, there's steps going down, about 14 steps, 18 steps, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You wound up going down about 9 feet below the ground level. And I'm starting to count these things now because of him.
Sure.
So you can count those 88, you know. You count 1, 2, 3, 4.
You're just timing the separation between the shells?
And you count to four, and you don't hear one. It's got your name. I turned around. I dove down these stairs, and I slid down on my belly. And down at the bottom, there was an aisleway about from here to the TV wall, wide. And I slid about halfway across it. And about that time, here comes this 88 down there, and it pokes his head out. It was sticking out about that far. And I'm laying there on this ground. I'm on my belly, and I'm looking at this thing. And I'm waiting for it to blow. It never did.
Wow.
Yeah, that was another incident.
Yeah, that's about as close as you can come right there.
That's the closest I ever came. Just looking at that 88 sticking out of the wall.
And I always wonder in something like that if it was sabotage, if it was, you know, some of the people, slave labor that...
People doing that, they were doing that.
Uh-huh.
They were sabotaging their own ammunition. Then there was an incident where a rail car gun, I guess that son of a gun was something like 18 feet long or something like that.
Huge, 20 feet long,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's on this flatbed rail made special for it to sit on.
Mm-hmm.
And you could hear them fire it back there about 8 miles. Boom. Then pretty soon, it was so big around and not long enough that it started cartwheeling and it sounded like a freight train coming. Well, when it hit Bestone, it went through about four buildings and landed in the middle of the street and blew up in the middle of the street. And it left a hole pretty close to 16 feet wide and about 8-9 feet deep.
And you saw that happen, or you just heard it coming over?
Oh, we heard it coming over.
Yeah.
And then we heard the explosion.
And then you went and saw the aftermath.
Yeah. And we called that old number 10 freight train.
I guess so. Glad you weren't in its way. I need to ask you about the Honor Flight. I'm here because Lili told me about you from Honor Flight Kern County. What was it like for you to go back to Washington, D.C. and see all of that?
Quite emotional. I took some pictures of it, and they got a wall. It's concave like that, and it's filled with stars. And then there's a caption that says, each star represents 100 killed soldiers.
In World War II. Yep. 406,000 Americans. And you've just given us examples of how close you came to being one of them.
Yeah, being one of them stars.
So looking at that wall got to you?
No, I just looked at it and said, oh, my God. Then we went to the Vietnam Wall.
Mm-hmm.
We went to about three or four of them. And the guy that was my guardian, he was a top sergeant in the Army. His name was Michael Alden. He took me over to a grave. He said, now, here's a man I like. It was Audie Murphy's grave.
At Arlington, yeah.
Yeah.
What was the most meaningful part of that whole experience? Because you see a lot there. You do a lot. They welcome you home. They write you letters. I mean, there's a lot of different aspects of this Honor Flight experience. What was the most meaningful for you?
Just being there. And I looked for different pillars in different states and everything, one for every state. I found California, and it was a very emotional experience.
Is that encouraging to know that people understand how significant what you guys did really is still today?
Some people appreciate it. Others don't even know there was a war.
Well, that's why we need guys like you to tell us about it, like you've done today.
I'm glad that I was able to do it.
I guess the other thing I didn't ask you about, there aren't too many people left who can say this, but you saw firsthand the horrors of a concentration camp.
Yeah, we were going down the road. I don't remember where we were headed, but we came out of this forest, and here's this fenced area with people. See, all one kind of uniform, striped, you know. The gate was shut. And it was locked. Our captain went to there to go in, but he couldn't because of the lock. And somebody got the lock or the chain off, I don't know. He went in, and there was bodies stacked as high as that television set. Just stacked. And that stack was something like maybe 15, 20 feet long. And these people that were still alive were so skinny, they were nothing but just plain skin and bones. And how they survived, I'll never figure it out. I guess they had the guts enough to survive. But it was nothing but bones and skin. No meat. No meat on them to speak of. And we started giving them our K rations and C rations and stuff like that. And the water and everything. Our officer told us, don't feed them too much because it'll kill them. Because they're not used to this. We slowed down, but we still fed a whole bunch of them, you know.
How difficult was that to see?
That was horrible. A horrible thing to see.
When you think back on that now, is there some satisfaction knowing that you guys got there when you did and that those people who were still alive?
And survived, yeah. And they survived on account of us being there. Otherwise, they'd have probably... There was people sitting on the ground and they were dying. People laying on the ground dying. Some were just hanging on the fence trying to stay alive. It was a horrible thing to see.
I'm sure you've got many more stories where that came from. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country.
Thank you
for telling us what you've shared with us. I know it's not easy to talk about some of it, but it helps us understand the price that's been paid for our freedom. Is there something that you would say that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I'm thankful that we did it, even though it was a horrible thing to do, but it was something that had to be done. not just 101st. I mean, every branch of the service. Mm-hmm. If it hadn't been for one another, I think we'd have still been talking German on the East Coast and Japanese on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. One last question I have to ask you, because I know that you and Violet have been married for 70 years. Not many people can say that. How'd you pull that off? What's your secret?
Just do what each other's supposed to do. If one says do this, both of you do it. If you had an argument in the daytime, regardless of what kind of an argument you had, when you go to bed, you kiss goodnight. That erased the arguments.
She's nodding her head. That's a good sign.
And if you'd like to see a photo of just how happy Len and Violet are after 70 years of marriage, pull up the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook or go to hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks again to Honor Flight Kern County and Lily Marsh for connecting me to the Oshners. They also made it possible for Len to go up in a C-47 again at age 94. Some pretty incredible history that this man has lived through, and what a privilege to share some of it with you. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.